Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Stoicism.
Comprehensive ancient theory about the emotions, about the well-lived life.
I think it's a good guide to life for us even today. It directs attention away from the way you feel about things and regarding happiness in the crude sense of feeling good about things or having a lot of pleasure to thinking instead about what kind of person to be.
She's so respected, cool, calm, collected.
Our guest is John Cooper from Princeton University.
When we say that the Stoics reject emotions, we need to make a distinction. The ones that they disapprove of, you might describe as passionate emotions. The sorts of feelings which I have, even on my best days, still get counted by them as passionate.
Stoicism, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at beautiful Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Beautiful and hot these days, and those conversations migrate from there to the air via the signals of this station and others, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Our topic today is Stoicism. You know, John, here's a test of the influence of Stoicism. It has an adjective named after it, you know, that's worked its way into ordinary language, and that adjective reflects part of the core of the meaning of the actual philosophical movements. Not many philosophical movements achieve that.
Well, that's true, and it contrasts with Epicureanism, and Epicure is now not really very related to what the Epicureans thought. But Stoicism means pretty much what the Stoics thought, this detachment from emotions. And as I've been reading about Stoicism, I've realized I am a Stoic. This is the inner me.
Yeah.
And frankly, Ken, I don't really care about any of this. I mean, I can't do anything about the fact that Stoicism is an adjective. I can't even do anything about the fact that our topic is Stoicism. I don't care. Arouses no emotion in me at all.
Oh, come on. Suppose, look, if this program is a disaster, which I doubt will happen, I'll be crushed. I mean, if the callers are stupid, if our guest says inane things, if you and I flub it, I'll be crushed. I'll be really disappointed.
Hey.
How will you feel?
Well, the same way I feel about the fact that Pluto is a cold planet, or that our president is possibly a complete idiot, or that anything else. It's beyond my control. I'm just completely placid about it. Who cares?
You're making Stoicism sound like just a philosophy of inaction. I mean, what are you going to do as a Stoic? I mean, our topic, it's your topic, it's my topic, is Stoicism. What are you going to do? Aren't you going to do your best? Aren't you going to give it your all?
You know, it could be I don't have this totally figured out. I was just so thrilled to find out that the fact that I'm basically not in touch with my emotions could be a philosophical virtue, that I've maybe gone a little overboard.
Yeah.
Is somebody going to help us understand this
yes,
mess called Stoicism?
I think you have gone a little overboard. And to help us get back on board, a roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, looked for reasons why 21st century people might care about Stoicism. She files this report.
Are you ever disappointed? Are you ever anxious about an exam? Do you have dating woes? Do you have trouble dealing with your parents? Are you ever frustrated? Do you ever get angry? If so, Stoicism can improve your life.
That's William Stevens, professor of philosophy at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, where he teaches a class in Stoicism. He says Stoicism is not all about being dispassionate and stern.
Well, there are good emotions and bad emotions. The good emotions are joy, caution, and rational wanting, according to the Stoics. And fear, greed, resentment, envy, jealousy, spite, all of these are bad emotions. Certainly anger is the worst of all.
Stoicism involves checking your emotions and realizing the limits of your control.
What makes us upset are our own judgments about events. So if somebody steps on my toe in a crowded movie theater, what's up to me is how I choose to evaluate that event. I can choose to get angry at the person who did it, but if it happened accidentally, why would I want to make myself upset by choosing to get angry?
Turns out, Stoicism is alive and well today. Take Tom Wolfe's novel, A Man in Full. Reading the Stoic philosopher Epictetus helps the main character deal with a string of bad luck that begins with getting laid off.
If your employer decides to lay you off, that's, of course, beyond your control. What's within your control is doing your job well. Because if you're doing your job well, you're focusing on what's up to you, and therefore you've earned your own self-respect. And so if somebody else lays you off, that's their decision. Yours is to decide what kind of job to apply for next.
People may not realize it, but Stoicism's everywhere in the Russell Crowe movie Gladiator.
It is all over the place. I mean, the opening scene with the battle, there you have Roman sobriety and seriousness, disciplined training of the soldiers, carefully ordered in their ranks, getting ready for the battle.
Will they fight, sir?
We shall know soon enough.
Soldier, I ordered you to move those catapults forward. They're out of range.
Range is good.
They don't fly into a frenzy because they're Stoic soldiers.
The trouble begins when the elderly Roman emperor, Marcus Aurelius, a famous Stoic philosopher in real life, chooses his disciplined general, Maximus Decimus, played by Russell Crowe, to guide the empire when he dies.
There is one more duty that I ask of you before you go home.
What would you have me do, Caesar?
I want you to become the protector of Rome after I die. Commodus is not a moral man. Commodus cannot rule. He must not rule.
The volatile Commodus gets angry, killing his father and Maximus's family. The Crowe character is forced to become a gladiator before stoically fighting his way to freedom.
He has a very tough time of it, and he goes through a number of tests, but he doesn't consider killing himself. He copes with his situation the best he can, even as desperate as it becomes throughout the movie.
Stoicism works well with the warrior ethic. Admiral James Stockdale, who spent 7 years in the Hanoi Hilton, looked to the philosophy when he was shot down over Vietnam.
Many of his fellow prisoners who did not have the liberal arts education that included learning Epictetus crumbled. It takes genuine mental discipline to be able to maintain self-respect and dignity in those circumstances. And Stockdale was able to do that. He was able to walk Epictetus's talk.
Strength and honor.
Strength and honor.
Strength and honor.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that very interesting piece. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor. And a point of pride, I don't know if pride is acceptable Stoic emotion, but Admiral Stockdale was actually a master's student at Stanford when Phil Rhinelander, a longtime member of the Stanford Philosophy Department, introduced him to Epictetus. And then subsequent to that, he ended up in the Hanoi Hilton, that is a prison camp in Hanoi, and found his training in Epictetus very good and very useful. He returned to the Hoover Institute and Stanford University and taught, along with Rhinelander, a number of courses for us.
Yeah, so. You know, I didn't know all that. But I remember Stockdale mostly for that, why am I here? Who am I as Perot's vice presidential running mate, you know?
Yes, he was Ross Perot's vice presidential running mate, and I think that wasn't a totally happy experience for him, something he had to be stoical about.
Well,
I'm sure he would have made a good vice president,
now,
though.
Now, joining us is our guest, John Cooper. He's the Stuart Professor of Philosophy at Princeton University. He's author of many books and articles on classical philosophy, including he's the editor of The Complete Works of Plato. John, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm glad to be with you.
Hi, John. John Perry here.
Hi, John.
So when we think about Stoicism, we usually think about emotional detachment, and we want you to tell us about emotions and what that is. But first, could you give us a sense of the rest of Stoic philosophy, where this all came from? Is there more to Stoicism than just this stuff about your emotions?
Briefly.
Yeah, I understand. In fact, one of the most interesting things about Stoicism as a subject of study, from a modern point of view as well as from a traditional one, is that they had the ambition to have a complete system of philosophy. Each of the views they held about emotions, they would look for all the consequences that those views might have for any other philosophical question. And then they would try to develop views on each of those philosophical questions on an independent basis, but one which would fit together with their views on emotions. And so they had a complete system, philosophy of language, logic, metaphysics, theology, epistemology, so all of it.
So was this what we now call a kind of pre-materialist philosophy or an idealist philosophy? I mean, what was their conception of the way the whole world worked?
Well, it would be wrong to say that they were materialists, although that's very often said. The truth is that they are what you could call corporealists. That's a funny term. We don't use it. Even in philosophy these days, it's not used.
Especially not on the radio. But.
Right. So what it means is that the only things there are bodies.
Ah.
So they think that reason, thought, is a body. And the reason why they think that is that reason, even reason, has to be able to have effects. If you think something, that changes things, right?
Yeah,
so it has to do something to something, and the only things that can do things to anything, they think, and the only things that can have anything done to them are bodies.
Well, you know, John, this all sounds kind of plausible to me. I'd be tempted I'd be tempted to explore that in depth, but I want to focus, get to the emotions. Because, you know, the adjective stoic has to do with this emotional detachment thing. If I want to understand, what exactly is an emotion for the stoic philosophers? Help us understand what an emotion is, and then we'll...
Yeah, okay. The thing is that when we say that the Stoics reject emotions, which is certainly in some sense true, we need to make a distinction among what you might think of as emotions as a whole group between some that they don't disapprove of, or a class of ones that they don't disapprove of, and ones that they do disapprove of. The ones that they disapprove of, you might describe as passionate emotions, or... They think of them as emotions in which you get carried away. Examples would be grief or anger.
How about love? Sort of,
even love, if that means a passionate attachment, yes. Such a thing as simply being elated when your baseball team wins, or depressed when your baseball team loses, or elated when you win something that you've been trying to get or get some recognition, that sort of thing. These they think of as states of feeling, which are not just feeling good or bad about something, but are ways of feeling good or bad about something where you get carried away.
Uh-huh. So, okay.
And the other sorts of, but there are other emotions, if you mean by an emotion any state in which you feel good or bad about something, right? There are others which they think of as not carrying you away. And those they don't disapprove of.
Before you get to the trouble, let's just remind our listeners and me who the Stoics were. We're talking about philosophers back in the B.C. period in Greece. Zeno, not the Zeno who worried about movement, but Zeno of something else. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. And then Cicero, a Roman philosopher later. Those are the two big Stoics. And then Marcus Aurelius, who was an emperor. Those are the big names in Stoicism?
Well, Zeno, he's the one from Kytium, by the way, which is a city in Cyprus. In fact, it's the modern city of Larnaca, about which you've been hearing as the place where all these refugees from Beirut have been taken, right?
Interesting. Okay.
So that's where he was from, and he came to Athens and opened a school after a few years of being there, just about 300 or a little before 300 B.C., in other words, 25 years after Aristotle died.
So we're talking about something that stretched clear from 300 B.C. through the beginning of Christianity. I mean, we don't want to spend too much time on history here.
I want to ask you about this being carried away
By the way, Cicero was not a Stoic.
Oh. Sorry about
that. That's okay. He wrote about the Stoics, but he was not a Stoic. He was an academic or a kind of skeptical Platonist.
I knew that probably at some point in my life when I had to take an exam.
John, after the break, I'm gonna ask you again about this being carried away. I'm not quite so sure about what's so bad about being carried away? But I want you to hold that thought for a second. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is Stoicism. Our guest is John Cooper from Princeton University, and we'd like you to join this discussion. 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area. Outside the Bay Area, call 1-800-525-9917.
We've been talking about who the Stoics were and their theory of emotions and Stoic understanding of the relationship between emotions, judgment, and reason. We'll continue that in the next segment and segue into Stoic ethics. Do you see examples in your life where Stoicism might help or hinder your moral development? Give us a call.
Emotional detachment, the well-lived life, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
And a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries.
I am a rock. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic today, Stoicism. Would our lives be better if we were never consumed by anger, never overcome with joy, if we never drowned in sorrow? The Stoics certainly thought so. What do you think? Join the conversation.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, you can still call toll-free even at 1-800-525-9917.
Or
you can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is John Cooper from Princeton University. John, you were making a distinction before the break between kind of these emotions that get us all worked up and these calmer ones. But I want to focus on the getting all worked up. I think take the question I put to our listeners. I mean, sometimes we're consumed by anger, but it seemed to me sometimes it's right to be consumed by anger at Hitler's persecution of the Jews, at the loss of somebody that you love deeply. It seems appropriate to be drowned in sorrow sometimes, to have overwhelming grief, and then to come out of it. What's so bad from the Stoics' view about these emotions that overcome you in this way?
Well, you may say that there are, and indeed many people do think, that there are times when it's appropriate to get very angry or it's appropriate to feel great grief. But the Stoics disagree, and they have good, I mean, they have a, I don't, I'm not saying that I agree with them, but they have a good basis for saying this. They think that if you do become agitated with anger or agitated with grief, what you are doing is expressing a judgment about whatever it is that the emotion is directed to, whatever has happened that it's directed to, namely that your life has actually been, the quality of your life has actually been affected for better or for worse by that happening to you. And they believe that that's just not true.
So if I lose my dearest love in a tragic way, then that doesn't affect the quality of my life? I mean, the quality of my life is surely partly constituted by the things to which I'm related.
Well,
and losses and gains, you know?
Well, no. I mean, they think and have good reasons for thinking that that's not true. What is true, that when you lose someone that you loved, then that something has happened in your life. But the question of the quality of your life with respect to its being better or worse is another matter. And they think that the only thing that affects the quality of your life is what you make of the things that happen to you.
Now,
the quality of your life with respect to its being better or worse as a life, I mean.
Now, John, I think it was Admiral Stockdale's hero Epictetus who said something like, "Oh, my master breaks my leg, too bad for him." Is that more or less right?
Well, yes.
I mean, at least in the classics illustrated version, does he say that?
Yes, that's funny, but yes, that's right. Yeah, too bad for him.
Yeah. Now, that suggests that the Stoics' idea of hurting me is rather limited and counterintuitive. Why would he say that? Is it the idea that really I can... The only thing that really affects me is what affects my deep inside subjective mental life? This is a very useful thing for prisoners of war to feel, to keep control over some aspect of their life. But is that really a philosophy for all of us?
Well, it isn't a matter of affecting the deep subjective your deep subjective mentality. It's really a matter of affecting the way in which you conceive of yourself as a person, the way you conceive of other people as agents, the way you conceive of other living things as having lives, of the world at large. and on the basis of that approach to things, then decide on what you do.
Let me press you. I just want to understand this a little better, John.
Yeah.
So look, the Stoics talk about things like health and wealth as external things,
right?
Things that are met, and they say external things should be matters of indifference. But, you know, ask most people, would you prefer good health to ill health or wealth to poverty? And most people will say, gosh, sure, I prefer good
and
health
so
to ill
the
health.
Stoics. So with the Stoics. Exactly what you've said is precisely the language that the Stoics use. They talk about, when they say that they're indifferent, what they only mean is that they are indifferent as to the goodness or badness of the life that you lead. It's not a matter of their being indifferent as to choice, because they precisely are. Health is precisely something which, as they put it in their language, is to be preferred. And so it's to be cared about. It's to be pursued within limits and in appropriate ways connected with other
things.
So why
doesn't that mean that the loss of it or the absence of it is a cause for, you know, frustration, unhappiness, dissatisfaction, you know?
Well, because if you get dissatisfied and get agitated in one of these passionate emotions, what you're doing is judging that it not just was something which was preferred and you didn't get it, or something preferred and you lost it, but that actually you're losing it affected the quality of your life for better or worse.
I think
I
see.
That's not true.
I think I see. We've got a whole lineup of callers on the line. Daniel in Houston, all the way from Houston. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Daniel.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to my call, and I'm a loyal listener. Thanks for your great show.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Well, thanks. So what's your question or comment all the way from Houston?
Yeah, I could have tons of them, but I'm not going to take them all. I know you probably just want me to give one. So let me ask about divine fire and the logos and the whole Stoic cosmology. To me, it on one hand, it sounds pretty primitive, but on the other hand, it seems to relate a lot to some of the things that we're discovering these days in terms of complex systems theory and so on and so forth.
Well, how about it, John? Were the Stoics kind of onto something?
Thanks, Daniel, for the call.
With some of this stuff?
Well, I don't exactly know what connections Daniel had in mind to contemporary discoveries or theories, but when I said at the beginning that the Stoics were corporealists, part of what I had in mind was that they believed that reason—that's logos in the Stoic—that's what Daniel was referring to. Logos is itself a body, and it's spread through the whole world, and everything that happens in the world happens through some decision of reason, which means of God, to move matter around in some way or other, right? And so the view that the Stoics hold, which Daniel was referring to, that there is this whole system of the world which is ruled by logos or reason which is spread through it, is itself connected to what the Stoics think about emotions through a connection to the fact that reason in us is itself exactly the same, so to speak, body that reason in the universe, i.e. God, is.
So is there God anything like the Christian God? Is it a personal God that has wishes and that you can pray to, or is it more just an abstract, if nevertheless material, principle?
It's a philosopher's God rather than a religionist's God or a theist's God. It's true that when you read in Epictetus and some of the later Stoics, what they say about Zeus—that's the Greek word for that—that's the Greek traditional god that they identify Lys Logos with. It's true that when you read them, he sometimes speaks of Zeus as if he were a father and all of that. But on Stoic theory, this is not something which is to be offered worship in the sense in which the traditional Greek gods or our Christian God is. And no one thinks, no Stoic thinks, that this entity intervenes in the course of things to favor certain individuals or answer our prayers or that kind of thing.
We've got an email right on this. This is from Linton. I don't know where he's from, but someplace where there's a Wells Fargo bank. He says, "Hi, I'm listening to this discussion and can't help but think about the similarity of Stoicism to Buddhism. Do you see the relationship? What do you think, John?"
Well, I don't know very much about Buddhism, but I do think there is a relationship. There certainly is the idea of sublimate. Well, I don't. That's a Freudian term, and probably I shouldn't have used it. But sublimating, getting above daily external circumstances, that's certainly crucial to the Stoic outlook.
We've got
I take that to be Buddhist too.
We've got a lot of callers on the line. David in Fremont's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David.
Thank you. Love your show. One of the things that came up for me was the idea of judgment. I tend to think of myself as a Stoic, but not knowing the background, this will be great to tell me whether I really am or not. But part of the problem has to do with the fact that I end up prejudging. And what comes up is the joke about the Ukrainian farmer who loses a horse, and everybody in the community says, oh, that's really bad. Then the horse comes back with a mate. And everybody in the community says, oh, that's really good. Each time he says, it's too soon to tell. And we don't really have enough information to give a good judgment. About the only thing you can do is just kind of hold it in limbo and let's see how things come out.
David, thanks for the call. John, I think that's getting at something important about Stoicism, as I understand it. Tell me if David and I have this wrong. One Stoic that I read says, look, if I knew my foot was going to be cut off, right, well, then I would cut it off, right? Because the well-lived life is to live in accordance with nature, right? And if things were just going to lead to my foot being cut off, well, I'd cooperate, right? And,
well, I think you're quoting Chrysippus, who was the greatest of the Stoic philosophers, but he didn't actually say he would cut it off. What he says is that... he talks about a foot, which of course is walks on the ground and gets all muddy, and so just as the foot, if it has a mind, he said, would want to get muddy, so he, if Zeus dictates that something that another person might regard as bad and affecting their life for the worse was going to happen to them, then he also, if he was be a good Stoic, would want that to happen.
Okay, so what will happen?
Of course, except that you don't know it's going to happen until it does, and so you can't will it in advance. What you have to do in advance is to do, so to speak, what's normal and natural. And you have to try for outcomes, and if they don't come, then that means Zeus hasn't wanted it to happen. And so since you are a rational person and so rational like Zeus, you should realize that Zeus had his reasons for this.
Right.
And you don't know what they are, and you never do know. But once it's happened, you accept it. Not just accept it because what else can you do, but you accept it because you realize that as a rational person, this is what, if you only understood Zeus's reasons, which you don't, you yourself would have wanted to happen.
Right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Stoicism with John Cooper from Princeton University. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134 or outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And Paul in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And welcome to John Cooper to the show. I wanted to get back to the topic of choice and control. And my question is, could you discuss what I guess some refer to as the fundamental distinction of Stoicism, which is the distinction between what's up to us and what is not up to us, or what's under our control and what isn't under our control.
Right.
And for the Stoic, as I understand the philosophy, we only exert genuine choice over those things that are under our control. And that might seem like an uncontentious claim, but, for the Stoic, what is and is not under our control is, really different than it is for most, the vast majority of people. And so, for example, in Stoic philosophers, you can find discussion of these moral dilemmas where, like an evil ruler kidnaps your family, and unless you commit some evil act, the ruler will put your family to death. And, Epictetus, for example, is unequivocal that, you don't engage in any kind of consequentialist reasoning about this. You act out of your principles, and you, don't do this evil act, and you basically chalk up your family dying, for example, to something out of your control. Whereas for Aristotle, when he discusses these kinds of examples, he says, well, it's morally reasonable for you to, reason about this and decide, well, okay, I want to save the life of my family, and so I'm going to go do this. So that's what I was wondering if you could talk about. And to me, the distinction, the way the Stoics cut it, seems kind of paradoxical because,
Paul, thanks. Let's have John weigh in here. Thanks, Paul, for the call. John, what do you think?
Well, Paul, the distinction you just drew between Aristotle and the Stoics is very apt. The thing is that the Stoics, although it's true that you read these passages that referred to from Epictetus, where it sounds as if he says, you know, your principles are such that you should allow anything horrible to happen to anybody and not be worried about it. But that's not really the Stoic view. The Stoic view is that you should, of course, do all the consequentialist reasoning you like. And you should certainly take into account all the effects, which you might or might not be able to control. And since you don't know whether you can control them or not, you should certainly give it a try. But the point is that you don't have absolute control. You don't dictate what will happen, except where it concerns your own mind and your own decisions. And so the basic distinction is that to recognize that what you do control is the kind of person you are, the way you live, the way you think about things, the way you go about things, and what you then do.
John, you know, there's that serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. You just said something. I mean, is it the case that can we know or can we not know in advance, you know, what we can or can't change? Or is that just something we have to try to see if we can change it or what?
Well, look, we certainly have a pretty good idea over which things we do have control over normally, under normal circumstances, and which things we don't. So there are, you know, there's a wide range, and the Stoics don't by any means deny this, along, you know, spectrum along which things stand. But the fact is that we don't absolutely control even the things which we think of and normally correctly think of as things that are up to us, such as it's up to me whether or not I pick up this pencil right now. But in fact, if Zeus wanted to paralyze my arm, then I wouldn't do it, would I?
Yeah. I'm still – okay, so look – so, again, is it that I should not regret the things that go the way I don't want, that I can't control? Is it that I should not regret them because if I did regret them, what, I would be lying to myself or something? I mean, I would be representing them as things that I could do something about? I mean, I don't quite understand. Why should I not deeply regret the bad things that happen that I couldn't do anything about? I can't stop whatever. I can't stop Hitler from rolling into Poland. Right. Yeah. Still, why can't I regret that?
Well,
why shouldn't I regret that?
If regret is an agitated emotion, passionate emotion, then you should not experience that, the Stoics say, because if you did experience it, you would be carried away, as I described earlier, and you would in effect be issuing a judgment that your life has been affected for the worse by the thing that you feel that way about, and that they think is not true.
Let me just
so you can, if you like, you could regret it in the sense that you wish it hadn't happened. If you could have prevented it, you would have, and all of that. But to get agitated over it is just, you know, that just is a mistake.
Let me kind of close out this segment with an email from one of our old friends, Pete in San Francisco. Hi, guys. In these times of warm fuzzies and Deepak Chopra, should I feel guilty for having Stoic tendencies? Isn't there much to be gained emotionally, spiritually, financially by maintaining mental self-discipline and emotional restraint? As they say, cool heads prevail.
We'll take that question up after the break. That's a perfect segue into our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Stoicism with John Cooper from Princeton University.
We've been discussing the Stoic theories of virtue and happiness. Coming up, we're going to ask whether the Stoic way of life really is a live option for us 21st century kind of guys. Feel free to call in at 415-841-4134 or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Stoicism as a guide to life in the 21st century. Plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Ain't That Tough Enough, the Fabulous Thunderbirds. Now that's their name, the Fabulous Thunderbirds. I'm not saying they're fabulous. I'm just saying that's the Fabulous Thunderbirds and Tough Enough. I, on the other hand, am John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Stoicism is our topic. Would our lives be better if we were never overcome by intense emotions. The Stoics certainly thought so, and maybe our last caller did too. What do you think? Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, you can still call us toll-free, 1-800-525-9917. And finally, you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is John Cooper from Princeton University. John, I never let you get a chance to say, we've talked about a lot about the emotions that the Stoics don't like.
Yeah.
Tell us more about the emotions that the Stoics think are acceptable in a self-governing, I guess it has to do with self-governing, autonomous person,
right.
I guess.
Right. No, that's right. I said before when we were first talking about this that there was some trouble, and we didn't have time to complete that thought. But the idea, which does make trouble, is that the emotions, that is, ways of feeling good or bad about things, which the Stoics approve of, are ones at Bill Stevens at the very beginning of the program in the Roving Philosophical Reporter section referred to this. They think are only available to someone who has so perfected their mind and their with understanding of what a human being is, what human nature is, how it relates to the rest of the world, how it relates to Zeus and so on, that when they go about their life, that'll be reflected in these very smooth, equanimous, so to speak, feelings of about things being good or bad that happen to them or that that someone else does, which are acceptable. The trouble is that in order to have acceptable emotions, you've got to be what they call a sage or a wise person. So that the sorts of feelings which I have, even on my best days, still get counted by them as passionate, even though they may not be all that strong, but only mild. Nonetheless, in feeling them, I'm being at least pushed towards, though I may be able to control them, losing control. And what they really don't like is losing control.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a lineup of callers on the line. Carol in Albany's on the line. It's been waiting for a while. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what's your comment or question?
Yes, I was really fascinated. I just finished reading Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, and I think in his discussion, which uses a lot of sort of modern neurobiology and modern studies to sort of explain how the brain works and how people in societies works, it seems to me that what you are calling emotions, he would call in a modern sense the unconscious mind, which sort of does the valet's job of making sure that your behavior in a situation is appropriate. It just sort of checks out without you really being aware and makes irrational and rapid kinds of decisions about what is and is inappropriate behavior. And that kind of includes some racist kinds of things that might make you cross the street when you see a young black man coming at you late at night and you're a lone woman. And then he says, you know, so those are things that need to be checked and need to be looked at, and you need to, you know, it's important to work that way. But then you need the conscious mind, and you need the, which would be what the Stoics might call the reason, which would help you to overcome things such as racism and things where you're using your emotional sense or your unconscious mind to make judgments that maybe aren't correct and
right.
Maybe need to be modified.
Carol, I think I've got you. So, look, thanks a lot, Carol. I think Carol's asking, I mean, there's like these primitive aversions and attractions that are there, but would the Stoics identify the passionate emotions with that kind of stuff that Carol's talking about, these kind of primitive aversions and passions? And then there's this part of us in the neocortex or something that enables us to, like, rise above them? I mean, yeah. Is that a kind of Stoic psychology?
No, I don't think so. I think what Carol is referring to is what the Stoics would regard as sort of primitive impressions that one might get. They make a big distinction between an impression and then a judgment. And so it may be that you, as you walk down the street, I know about this kind of example from hearing about psychological theory, and you see a black person ahead of you, you then cross, you feel like crossing the street, and maybe you do cross the street. But the Stoics draw a distinction between the impression which you get when you notice this person in front of you, where you have a feeling of something ominous, right? Racist. And then what you do about it. And if you cross the street, then they think you've now decided to do that. And now you've got over the line into the area where emotions are possible. Emotions for them are ways in which you feel, because in feeling that way, you think that that's a suitable way to feel.
So emotions are more like judgments rather than these kind of primitive motivations
exactly.
that are not conscious. I mean, exactly. they're already kind of complex. And I guess the problem with a lot of them for the Stoics is that they're false judgments, right?
That's exactly right.
But let me ask you a question. The Stoics had this funny metaphysics, this funny theology, all this, and probably most people wouldn't believe it. But right. should anybody care about Stoicism as a guide to life in the 21st century? I mean, go back to, I think it was Pete's email. He said he thinks Stoicism sounds cool.
Right.
I mean, what do you think as a guide to living an actual human life in the 21st century?
Yeah. Well, there are two things that I say quickly. First of all, there's a very good book which people might want to read called A New Stoicism by Lawrence Becker, published several years ago by the Princeton University Press, in which Becker argues on the basis of modern science, not on the basis of this funny science or this funny theology that the Stoics used in their own theories, that the Stoic theories really stand up very well. So that's one thing. The other thing is that, to answer the question, I think it's a good guide to life, at least to this extent, for us even today, without getting into believing in Zeus and all this other stuff. namely that it directs attention away from the way you feel about things and regarding happiness in the sense, the crude sense of feeling good about things or having a lot of pleasure in life, to thinking instead about what kind of person to be and what to make of your life as a person, as an agent. And the Stoics have big ideas, which we might not find acceptable, as to exactly what it is to be a good person. But the idea that you should think of your happiness, as they do, as consisting really in being a certain kind of person and living a certain kind of way, whether or not your efforts succeed, that's another matter. That's not up to you in every case.
John, so what if some of our listeners want to read some of the Stoic stuff in the original? Or at least in a translation of the original.
Yeah, right.
Is there a good little book that gives you Chrysippus and Zeno and what you need of that, or that you could recommend?
Well, the trouble is there really isn't. The best... One thing to do is to read a work of Cicero's. I mentioned earlier that he's not a Stoic, but he was very interested in Stoic theory, called On Moral Ends. And in book three of that five-book work, it's about 80 or 90 pages, he expounds the Stoic theory, Stoic ethical theory at any rate.
So they can pick up a paperback of Cicero...
On Moral Ends.
On Moral
That's
right. Ends. Okay.
You're right. Yeah. The other thing they can do is that there's a more comprehensive book in translation by A.A. Long and D.N. Sedley called The Hellenistic Philosophers. And there you get all these materials collected and discussed in 8 or 10 chapters on the Stoics. There are other Hellenistic philosophers too, but there's a whole section on the Stoics.
I want to ask you one really quick question. There's a caller in line that we can't get to, but I see the question that he would ask. And it seems to me a great question. Is there anything, is anger or some correlate, some calm correlate to anger, like moral indignation, ever acceptable for the Stoics? I mean, can we ever regard the world and say, darn it, you did evil, you did wrong? Is there any situation in which that's okay?
No, there's no situation in which that's okay. You can certainly say and believe and take action on the basis that they did evil and that was wrong. But what you can't get, what they don't allow, is that you get agitated about it, that you get upset about it.
Okay, well, so I'll try not to be upset.
Yeah,
I'll make so my judgment, but not be that.
You can go right ahead and judge as much as you want,
okay.
At least within limits.
Now, John, you are on my list of more passionate people, and Ken, too, so I think both of you need to be more like me, cool, calm,
right.
collected,
well, I
never
try.
Agitated.
John,
you know?
I try.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, on that note of trying, John Cooper, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a delight having you.
Well, I'm glad to have been asked.
Our guest has been Professor John Cooper. He's a professor of philosophy from Princeton University, editor of The Complete Works of Plato.
And we want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to. We had several good emails we didn't get a chance to get to either, so thanks a lot, and don't get too agitated about the fact we didn't call on you.
Don't get too frustrated or angry or disappointed. That would be wrong. That would not be self-governing. So, John, you started out a Stoic guy, sort of, I guess. Are you still Stoical after this experience?
Well, I'm kind of have mixed feelings about Stoic. Stoicism. I think the basic idea of kind of keeping your emotions in control, who can argue with that? And it kind of appeals to me as a person who was raised in Nebraska and taught early to, you know, keep my emotions under check. On the other hand, I'm not sure that some of the basis of it seems really not too plausible.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I think it's wrong root and branch in a certain way, because I think it's based on something that John Cooper said this, that it's a mistake to think that the quality of your life depends on these external things. I think that's wrong. I think the quality of my life, I'm vulnerable to losses and gains from external things. And the Stoics want to say, no, you're not. You're not vulnerable. If you're a really good person, you're not vulnerable to these external losses and gains. But I just think that's wrong.
Well,
I don't think that's the nature of a human being.
At the point of sounding like a mushy mouse philosopher always looking for the compromise, I think there's something to it, and it's something that's very valuable for people like in Admiral Stockdale's position to keep in mind, that there is an inner core that it remains pretty unaffected and can remain pretty unaffected by many of these external circumstances and pretty much whatever other people do.
There's something right about that. That's that thing, if you're given lemons, make lemonade, right? So, and that a virtuous person would do that, so that there's a sort of character of the will that's independent of that. But the Stoics, I think, carry this too far. But anyway, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I sometimes blog.
Yes, and you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. You know, there's one guy on our staff, Ken, who is rarely emotional about life's vagaries, and so it's fitting that he get the last word on Stoicism. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, Stoicism got its name from the porch, or stoa, in which its early members gathered and held lectures. The Stoics' goal was to be free of passion or suffering through clear thinking. Nowadays, we equate Stoicism with phrases like Stoic endurance. Ross Perot's running mate, Admiral James Stockdale, credited Stoicism with helping him get through his experience as a POW in Vietnam. More perversely, when G. Gordon Liddy put his hand in a candle flame, it was viewed as an exemplar of stone-faced Stoicism. We describe the Norwegian bachelor farmer looking at his corn crop destroyed by a hailstorm as Stoic. It is the philosophy of the shrug, of stuff happens, of not being surprised by life, comme ci, comme ça, que sera, sera. Back in the day, Stoics did in fact hold that emotions, specifically those that cause distress, come from false judgments. A true sage would not submit to them. Further, as one Stoic put it, no impression arising from something true is such that an impression arising from something false could not also be just like it. They're not generally remembered as pranksters, but there's a story that one Stoic was tricked by another into thinking that wax pomegranates were real, proving that just because something seems real doesn't mean that it is. It's all in the mind. Therefore, a movement towards something, when inspired by a base emotion like desire, does not mean that the thing is necessarily desirable. Wanting the right thing, in other words, is more important than getting it. The only person we can be sure has any knowledge is the Stoic sage. The rest of us are just slaves to our emotions, playing a sucker's game, buying lottery tickets, shouting at soccer matches, trying to find true love on the internet. Stoics, as you can imagine, had a reputation for being rather cold fish. In 155 BCE, a Greek Stoic spoke in Rome at a symposium. On one day, he argued that justice was a genuine good. On the next day, he argued that it was not. His dialectical skill wowed the crowd, but fueled a distrust of philosophy in Greater Rome. When a Roman Stoic criticized the emperor and the Senate in the 1st century BCE, he was executed. All philosophers were banished from Rome and later from all of Italy. Whether Stoics endured this persecution with Stoic calm is not recorded. But Emperor Marcus Aurelius, perhaps to make up for this mistreatment, established Stoic professorships in Athens and other cities in 176 AD. Marcus Aurelius also wrote the Meditations, still widely read today, most notably perhaps by President Clinton. Marcus Aurelius remains probably the most well-known Stoic and one of the last. He wrote, "If you are distressed by any external thing, it is not this thing which disturbs you, but your own judgment about it, and it is in your power to wipe out that judgment now." The distress-free Marcus wrote the Meditations during a 10-year war campaign, and he was not one to shrink from persecuting Christians. All in all, it seems to me that writing a book about the insignificance of worldly affairs is rather an odd activity for a Roman emperor, but hey, whatever. Que sera, sera. Empire happens. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.